Not really. There is a distinction between those two terms. A term might not be ambiguous as far as its meaning goes, but there may be some questions as to what its limits are, just how far you need to take it. And the term may not be ambiguous, meaning that it has more than one meaning. It only has may only have one meaning, but we're not sure what the limit of the meaning is. And so definition often will serve to define its limits in a given context. And you might say, now, by this term I mean it in this sense and to this extent and no farther. In other words, defining the limits of your term to reduce vagueness. You see, an ambiguous term is one which can have two or more meanings depending on the context. It can mean more than one thing. But a term is vague when there are borderline cases in which it cannot be decided whether the term applies or not. You know, in this situation, I'm not sure whether the term applies for sure or not. For example, in biology, there's always been a difficulty in trying to decide whether a virus is living or non-living, you know. And depending on how a guy defines life, you know, he may consider it life or not life. So you need to define terms such that these borderline cases won't be so vague. You'll be able to decide whether you're going to call it this or you're going to call it that. This is really important in legal documents and in technical subjects. You know, legal documents, this is one of the reasons that legal documents are so verbose, is that they're trying to give limitations to all of the terms that they're using, so the term might not be misunderstood and know where it applies and where it doesn't, this kind of thing. In evolutionary reputation, we discussed the fact that the word kind in Genesis, where it says after kind, is not necessarily the same term as species in biology. And so we gave a limiting definition there to reduce the vagueness of the term kind. We said a kind in the scriptures is any group of living things that can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. So we gave a very specific limitation to the term. Now, the word species in biology, there's some big arguments about, you know, what a species consists in. And you've got the lumpers and splitters, you know, and some are trying to split things up into more, and others are grouping together. And so you've got a real vague, the term species is a very general, very vague term. You're not quite sure whether something fits that category or another category because of the kinds of definitions that are used. And so it's not too much of a problem if you're in a given textbook, they'll define it in a certain way, and then you can refer to that. But then you get another textbook, and you define it a different way, and now you don't know what to do. All right. So to reduce vagueness is one of the purposes for definition. And in theology, we need to be careful, too, as we use a term to make sure that we qualify that term as to what we mean and the other person understands it so that there's no confusion. Now, to another purpose for definition is to explain things theoretically, to explain theoretically. This is in a more specialized sense. When you're dealing with theoretical concepts or dealing with some very specialized technical context, you need to define your terms in relationship to the other terms in that context. In other words, if you're dealing with physics and you want to define force in physics is defined as F equals ma, mass times acceleration. That's the physical definition of force. And so you are relating the concept force to the other technical terms in that realm, defining in terms of mass and acceleration, which are things to measure and so forth. Now, in common language, force can mean a lot of things. Can mean something you feel. You feel a force on me or something like that. Technically, in physics, you don't really. The force is mass times acceleration. If you don't have any movement or acceleration, you don't have any real force there. See? But we might not say that. So, in common day, everyday language, so terms will take on more limited and special significance within certain contexts of theoretical discussion or relating concepts together. In theology, for example, in the Bible, we see a lot of Greek words that come out of classical Greek and were used in a certain way in classical Greek that take on a more limited and specific significance in the scriptures. The word ecclesia, for example, for the church. That word is used in a far looser sense in classical Greek, but when you see the word in the Bible, it takes on a specific technical distinction. In the Bible, it refers to the called out ones, those called out of the world and into Christ. And so the term takes on a certain significance in the context of the Bible that it would not necessarily have in classical Greek writing. If you're reading some classical Greek author and you see the word ecclesia, you know that's not the Church of Jesus Christ. It has the incoming existence. So it carries on special significance. It's defined with relationship to other concepts. And the word church is defined in the Bible as the assembly has called out ones the same, the set apart ones, set apart unto God. So it's related to terms within that context. Yeah. Well, it's not necessarily always different. Sometimes it'll be the same. It's reducing vagueness, all right. But it's in the context of some certain technical field that you're dealing with. In other words, in physics and science or in theology or something, as opposed to everyday language. In other words, the previous one can be applied even in everyday language. When you're conversing with somebody, you use a term, and then they're wondering, you know, how far you've taken that term, and you may define it more thoroughly, more specifically, as far as the limits of it. In this next sense, it's in the context of some theoretical field that you're dealing with, where you're defining it in terms of things that you're dealing with in that particular field that may have some special significance that they wouldn't have otherwise. So it's only kind of a distinction with reference to specifically what you're dealing with in terms of technical fields, especially in sciences where you see that you're going to define the terms in terms of other terms that you've used and are used in that scientific context. And those terms may not be used the same way as they're used out in the world in everyday life. Okay, and then the definitions are often used to influence attitudes. This is the last one that I'll discuss. Influencing attitudes. How do you define things to influence attitudes? Well, you might redefine a term or define a term with the purpose of influencing another person's attitude toward that term or to stir emotions about that term. For example, if you define socialism as democracy extended to the economic field, okay, well, the reason that that term is defined that way is to generate positive attitudes toward it. Because socialism itself, in a democratic society, is going to have a negative connotation, I think it did a few years ago. But to say it's now democracy, which everybody's supposed to be for democracy, and once you say democracy, everybody smiles, you know. And democracy extended the economic field. So you redefine it in terms that people will have a positive association with. So this is getting into that emotive value, emotive function of language. You'll try to define things in terms that people will like to hear and that they'll have positive emotional associations with if you're trying to get them to have a positive emotional association with the term that you're using. The same kind of thing can happen with evolutionists, defining evolution as simply change. Evolution is just change. You believe in change, you're an evolutionist. Why be so upset about the term evolution? It just means change. You see? And that is an inroad to you to get a positive attitude toward the term evolution, which can then be built upon by bringing in other aspects, you see, and eventually can lead the person away. So people will do that oftentimes in argumentation things, is redefine a term in such a way that a person will have a positive emotional association with it. Communism being defined as liberation of the masses, you see. Liberation, it should always be for liberation, setting free, you see. And so you define it that way and you get a positive association with it if the person's not so sharp in what you're doing. Okay, so that can often be done. That needs to be watched for, too. When you're talking to somebody, don't switch definitions and things to try to do this very thing, get an emotional response. This is one of the techniques of propaganda all the time, you know, redefining things. Like we see in the book of Isaiah, what are them to call evil good and good evil? That's what they're doing. Now, you can say a lot about the details and technicalities of definition. There's a whole discussion that you can go into on this, but it would take too much time for our purposes, I think. For our purposes, I think the overall important thing is to make our definitions and terms as clear and unambiguous as possible. If you're writing a theological treatise or something to people outside who are not familiar with what's going on in your community chapel, then we need to use a lot of cliches and terms that are understood in the context of our relationship with one another, but they may not be understood out there. And so we want to be real clear to define our terms and look at it from the standpoint of somebody who's not necessarily knowing what you're talking about. And when you're making argumentation and building premises and drawing conclusions, it's important there to make sure that the terms are not ambiguous and are clearly defined in the context of your theology. And of course, in theology, our definitions of theological terms should relate to biblical concepts and terms, not to church fathers or something like this. Tying to the Bible, tying to the scriptures, and related to what the Word of God says. That's the basic thing we need to follow there. Okay, any questions or comments on this general area of definition? The central point I'm getting at is trying to, because language has these ambiguities, we want to try to eliminate it as much as possible and communicate as accurately as possible when we're writing, and so forth. Now, that leads into the subject of symbolic logic, and that's the next deep subject we'll deal with. This will be the main subject we'll deal with for the rest of our time. I've got time at the end. I'll say a few things about induction, too, but this is the rest of our time is largely going to be devoted to symbolic logic. Now, in order to avoid many of the problems associated with languages that we've already seen, ambiguities, terms used in different ways, various functions of language, things like this, it's convenient to set up an artificial symbolic language that's free from these defects, in which to formulate and test the validity of arguments. And so we're going to set up a different kind of language, a symbolic language, in which we can look at arguments, look at the raw arguments, independent of the subject matter that we're dealing with. We can look at the relationship between the arguments and the structure of the argument itself, using symbols to represent the individual propositions, and we can study the logic independent of the subject matter. And that's what we're really trying to do here, in symbolic logic. So we're not going to be studying theology per se here, we're going to be studying the logic of propositions, propositional calculus, as it's called, or calculus of propositions. It's a fancy term, you don't even need to use it if it scares you. But it's looking at the structure of arguments and the validity of arguments based on the logical structure. As I've already mentioned, this is not a guarantee as to the truth of your conclusion. In order to have a good argument, a true argument, and a true conclusion, you need to have a logical argument and true premises. This is only going to help us look at the arguments themselves, not at the premises. But since we start out with a whole set of true premises in the Bible, we're in good shape. So if we get the logic part down, we should be able to be in real good shape as far as understanding the Word of God. Now, using this symbolic logic language results not only in more precision, but in the ability to do far more complex problems with greater ease. Now, you know, when I gave you that little problem about the railroad men and so forth, that it takes some time. You can't just read through that and dash it off just like that. You need to stop and look at it and arrange things and see how this relates to that and so forth. And when you've got language like that, you can't just go through some quick manipulation of terms and things like a math problem and come up with it that quickly. But there's a way to translate that into a symbolic language of symbols where you can work that thing out very, very quickly just by using rules without even knowing what the individual, you know, things are. And then at the end, you can crank out the answer here and translate it back in the other language, and you've got it. And so I'll show you a way to do that kind of problem far more quickly with this symbolic language. It's simplifying things. It's enabling you to handle a lot more complex things without getting confused because you get led astray by different functions of language and things. Now, for example, if you were going to try to multiply in Roman numerals, let's suppose you I tell you to multiply this by this. See? How are you going to do that? Okay? It's very awkward. Roman numerals are very awkward for this kind of thing. It could be done, but it's really awkward as compared to 13 times 9. That's a lot easier to work with. In other words, these symbols lend themselves to manipulation far more readily than these symbols do. And so it is with symbolic logic. When you're dealing with sentences and language and things and verbs and subject, this kind of thing, it's a lot harder to manipulate those things in a logical framework than it is to use symbols. Symbols can far more easily be manipulated because you're not dealing with being distracted by the symbol itself, but you're looking at the operations and the connections and the functions of one relationship to another. And this is the reason why symbolic logic was developed, is to facilitate not only quickness, but real precision in dealing with logical problems. And so that leads into the subject of the calculus of proposition. And again, there's nothing fancy about these terms, but this is a phrase you'll see very often. Calculus of proposition. We're just making calculations, making logical manipulations with propositions symbolized by a certain term, a symbol. Now, this involves using symbols to represent propositions. Instead of just making a statement about something, you just use a symbol to represent that statement, and then use the symbol to represent the other statement, and so forth, and tie these things together with other symbols. And so these symbols are often termed as variables, just like in algebra. Some people have a hard time going from arithmetic to algebra because they they want to have things always known and tied down, but in algebra, you can use X's and Y's, A's and B's and C's to represent any number. And you can deal with the equations and the manipulations of these, not knowing what the individual numbers are, but looking at the relationships with them independent of what numbers actually fit. And then when you've got the numbers to plug into them, you can draw certain conclusions. And so this is essentially what we're doing with our logic. We're looking at the structure of the arguments, independent of the information or the subject matter, and then having the subject matter, you can plug that into these logical form arguments and draw conclusions from them. All right. So first we want to look at some real simple arguments, some basic arguments. Let's take the argument, the man has a red hat or the man has a white hat. Okay, so the man has a red hat or the man has a white hat. That's our first statement. Or the white hat. And then your next premise is the man does not have a red hat, and the conclusion is therefore the man has a white hat. Okay. This is a simple, what's called a syllogism. Syllogism is an argument, a deductive argument, with two premises and a conclusion. Actually, that's just the way it's defined. So that's what we have here. Premise number one, premise number two, and then a conclusion. That's generally called a syllogism. There's different kinds of syllogism. It's not to be a disjunctive syllogism, but don't worry about that right now. Okay? So this is just a simple deductive argument. The man has a red hat or the man has a white hat. The man does not have a red hat, therefore the man has a white hat. That's the same kinds of things that you use to figure out this problem about the railroad. Okay, here's another one you can put down. If Mr. Robinson is the brakeman next door neighbor, then Mr. Robinson lives halfway between Detroit and Chicago. Okay, you might want to abbreviate as much as you can here. I think you're probably familiar with it. There's one other argument that I didn't put down in the Latin. It's called ad nauseum.
We use that term all the time.
But you may be to that point with this particular problem, I don't know. But so if Mr. Robinson is the brakeman's next door neighbor, then Mr. Robinson lives halfway between Detroit and Chicago. That's premise number one. Premise number two, Mr. Robinson does not live halfway between Detroit and Chicago. And then the conclusion is, therefore, Mr. Robinson is not the brakeman's next door neighbor. I'll just repeat it again, just to put it down here for a model that we'll be looking at here. If Mr. Robinson is the brakeman's next door neighbor, then Mr. Robinson lives halfway between Detroit and Chicago. Mr. Robinson does not live halfway between Detroit and Chicago, therefore Mr. Robinson is not the brakeman's next door neighbor. Okay. Arguments of these types, there are really two basic kinds of syllogism, both are syllogisms here. But arguments of this general type can contain at least one compound statement. And a compound statement is simply a statement that's more than one simple statement in a proposition. For example, our first statement here is the man has a red hat or the man has a white hat. That's a compound statement. That's taking two statements and putting them together. The man has a red hat and the statement the man has a white hat. And then connecting them with or. And then the next statement, the man does not have a red hat. That's a simple statement. That's just one single statement, not a compound. So a compound is just putting more than one simple statement together in various different ways. There's different types of compound statements. And these are important to us as far as putting things together logically. The first type of compound statement that we'll deal with is what's called the conjunction. The conjunction. Now, a conjunction is pretty straightforward. The conjunction is formed by placing the word and between two statements. And the two statements are called conjuncts. So, you have two statements, and you connect them with the word and. And you have a conjunction. And the two parts that are put together are called conjuncts. Two conjuncts connected together by and. So, let's take, for example, the statement, Jesus is man, and Jesus God. Okay? We have two statements. Jesus is man, Jesus is God, connected by and. And these are two conjuncts. The whole thing is called a conjunction. Two statements that can join together. Now, it should be noted here, although we probably won't run into this very often, but the word and does not always join statements. Sometimes the word and can be used in different ways, too. But, for example, if I say Peter and Paul were contemporaries, that's one simple statement about a relationship. Because you can't say Peter was a contemporary and Paul was a contemporary, because the word contemporary is relative, speaking of a relationship. Contemporary of who, you see. But if I say Peter and Paul were contemporaries, I mean that Peter and Paul both lived at the same time. That is not a compound statement. That's a simple statement about two people. So that's not putting two statements together. Now you will find, you could say Jesus is man and God. Well, actually that's a compound statement, because it's made up of the statement Jesus is man and Jesus is God, is what you're really saying. So sometimes in language, we'll streamline our language a little bit so we don't repeat the subject or something, but that still doesn't make it necessarily one statement. It's still two statements. So if you can break it down into two separate statements, you've still got a compound statement.
Okay.
From a logical standpoint. If I said Lewis and Clark were famous explorers, well, that's a compound statement. That's why you have Lewis was a famous explorer and Clark was a famous explorer. But that's different than saying that Lewis and Clark were contemporaries, because to say they were contemporaries is talking about a relationship between the two. And that's something you don't need to really worry about too much. You're not going to find a statement like they were contemporaries very often anyway. Most of the time when you see and, it will be joining compound statements like this. Okay, now in logic, we use the symbol a dot, technically called a dot, to indicate a conjunction. And so, if I want to make the statement Jesus is man and Jesus is God, in logic, the way you'll do it is put a dot between the two. And that reads, Jesus is man and Jesus is God. That dot symbol signifies a conjunction. Jesus is man and Jesus is God. Or in general, if we want to make a general statement, if I've got any two statements, P and Q, any two statements whatsoever, then the symbol P dot Q is the conjunction between P and Q. So that's our general definition. So if I've got any statements P and Q, no matter what statements they are, their conjunction is P dot Q. That represents the conjunction of them. That means P and Q. Now, since every statement is either true or false, at least a simple proposition like this, it's either going to be true or it's false, every statement has a truth value. The truth value of a statement is true if the statement is true and false if it's false. That's the truth value. In some logic books, you'll see them use the symbols 1 for true and 0 for false. Or in lots of them, you'll just use a T or an M. But the truth value is simply, if the statement is true, its truth value is true or 1. And if the statement is false, its truth value is false or 0. So there's an only kind of truth value estimations that we'll have here. Positive or negative, true or false. Now the truth value of a compound statement like this is determined by the truth value of its component statement. And it depends on what kind of conjunction what kind of symbol you have in between. Now let me just illustrate this, and there's a convenient way to illustrate truth values of statements, and that's called a truth table. And let's take a look at the truth table for this conjunction. This is really the technical way that these conjunctions are defined. They're defined by the truth tables for each one of these. So let's just take our PQ, P and Q, and P dot Q, and look at these. All a truth table is doing is considering all of the various possible combinations of truth values. In other words, if I've got two statements, P and Q, then I've got four possibilities. It's just like flipping a coin. P can be true and Q false. P can be true and Q true. P can be false and Q true. And P can be false and Q false. So the combinations are like this. Usually the way you set it up is this way. True, true, false, false. And then true, false, true, false. These are the different combinations. So either both are true. P is true and Q is true. P is true and Q is false. P is false, Q is true. Or P is false and Q is false. They're both false. That's just like flipping a coin. It's just looking at the different possible combinations of two statements, the possible truth values that they can have.
Now, for P dot Q, P and Q, we look at these and determine the truth value of the total statement. So, if P is Q, P is true and Q is true, then what is going to be the truth value of the statement P and Q? That'll be true, right? Because if both are true, then P and Q, that statement is true. They're both true. Okay, if P is true and Q is false, though, then the statement P and Q, is that going to be true or false? It's false because one part is false, you see. The only way it can be true is both parts to be true. Say P and Q are true, that statement is a lie if Q happens to be false. Because then P and Q aren't both true. P is true and Q is false. So the whole statement P and Q is not true. Okay? Everybody following me so far? Okay. Now, if P is false and Q is true, then the statement P and Q is going to be what? False, for the same reason. Now, in this case, the P part of it is false. The only way the statement can be true is if both parts of it are true. And then, obviously, if both parts are false, then the statement is false also. So there's the truth table for the conjunction P dot Q. This, actually, is what defines P dot Q. This expression means this truth table. In other words, it means that when the only way this expression can be true is if both P and Q are true, and it's false in every other case. Okay? So that's how we technically define P dot Q. And later when you start working problems and things, this is the definition that you use, figuring out more compound expressions. Okay, so this table then is taken as the definition of the construction conjunction P dot Q. Now, it should be noted that other English words can join statements other than the word and. In other words, if you're finding a statement, it may use a different word than and to join two statements, and it'll still be logically the same. It'll still translate P dot Q. For example, words like but, yet, also, still, although, however, or moreover, such and such, they can be, depending on the context in which they're set and so forth, they can be joining two statements. And logically, it will still come out P dot Q. If you can see from the grammatical structure that you've got a conjunction type of thing. Sometimes translations get a little bit tricky. Usually it's not difficult to tell whether two statements are being conjoined. So all I'm saying is that they may not always have the word and, but there'll be a conjunction between the statements. So clearly seen from the structure. Oh, okay, I'll just read them here. But, in other words, such and such, but such and such, can be construed logically as these things are both true. So, but, yet, also, still, although, however, moreover, all of those can be translated as a dot, depending on the circumstances, of course. Not all of these words are always going to mean that. You have to look at the picture, what it's getting at. Okay. Even a comma or a semicolon can be, suppose you've got a whole list of statements, and sometimes we'll use commas instead of using the word and describing or something. Then you can string a whole P, Q, R, S, and put all the different statements together and not put them all. Okay. Now, there's another important symbol in logic before we look at some more types of compound statements that we need to introduce here, and that's the negation, or the denial of a statement. Negation. Now, a negation of a statement is formed logically by putting the word not into the original statement. Or you could say it is false that. In other words, if your statement is, if your statement is Jesus is man, then the negation of that statement would be it is false that Jesus is man, or Jesus is not man, or not Jesus is man. And the best way to think of this is just putting the negation on the front of it, because sometimes you can get some little subtle trickeries and subtly be negating only part of it, not the whole thing. So if you just think of it as saying not this, or it is not the case that, or it is false that, so forth, that will help you out in determining how to set this thing up. For example, if your statement is all humans are mortal, the negation of that statement is, it is not true that all humans are mortal, or not all humans are mortal. Or that can be even translated as some humans are mortal.
if you define some as meaning not all. See, it's not saying, though, that no humans are mortal. The statement that all humans are mortal is negated by the statement not all humans are mortal, not by the statement no humans are mortal, because no humans are mortal is a different proposition entirely. It's not just a negation of that. So the thing, what you think of is just put a not in front of it. That will, and then see what it says. Or it is false that all humans are mortal. It's false that all humans are mortal. See, that statement could be true if even one human is not mortal. Okay. Now, if that statement then is P, if the statement P is all humans are mortal, then the symbol that we'll use to negate it is what's called a curl. And just a little squiggly line. Not P. So if P is our statement, then not P is the negation of that statement. If P is all humans are mortal, then not P is not true that all humans are mortal, or not all humans are mortal. Okay? And if we look at this from a truth table definition, let's put the truth table for this function here. In this case, we only have P to worry about, and P can either be true or false. So those are in the combination. Not P is going to be, if P is true, not P is going to be what? Negation of it. That'll be false. Okay? And if P is false, then not P is going to be true. So it's just reversing the truth value of the function. And this is the way it's defined logically. Not P, or curl P, this is the curl symbol, is defined as the negation, meaning that if you're, whatever your statement's truth value was, its negation is going to be the opposite. Okay. So that's just one to throw in here as far as the symbol. This is going to be used quite frequently. Not P, that is the negation of P, whatever P is. Okay, now let's get to any questions on this before we get to our next compound statement. We're just putting the elements together of our symbolic logic, and you'll see how these things begin to work. You may wonder, what are we doing here? What good is this going to do? But you'll see a little bit later on how slick this thing is as far as figuring out complex expressions and things that would take you forever to figure out if you just had them all written out in language. The next one we'll deal with, the next kind of compound statement, is the disjunction. We have the conjunction, now this is the disjunction. Or it's sometimes called alternation. Disjunction or alternation. Now this is formed in English by inserting the word or between the two components. So you've got two component statements connected by the word or. And the two components are called disjunct. Instead of conjunct, now disjunct, connected by the word or. And the sometimes will be called alternative. We use the word alternative, either this or that. So disjunct or alternatives. They're connected by the word or. Now there's one slight problem with that, because the word or in English can mean different things. The word or in English can mean either one or the other, but not both, which is the exclusive tense. It's either this or that, but it's not both. One or the other. So when we see the word or in English, it can refer to that in some context. Or it could mean one or the other or both. Either this or that or both. And so that introduces a slight ambiguity here as to what we mean by the word or. Now in logic, we define it to be one or the other, and we'll define the other one in terms of that. So in logic, when we see the word or, we are using it in the inclusive sense. That is, in logic, the symbol that we use in logic is the V, and that symbolizes one or the other or both. So it's the inclusive sense of the word or. One or the other or both. And that's the way, as it turns out in our language, that's the way it almost always is meant when you say either this or that. That's the way you almost always mean it or both. If in some context you are really meaning one or the other but not both, there's another way to write that in logic, and I hope I'll get to it today. I'll show you how to do it in terms of some other things we've seen. So we can do that, but this symbol in logic means one or the other or both. Okay, now let's look at the truth table. Suppose we have two statements, P and Q, and we want to look at the truth table for this disjunction. So we've got P and Q,
And now we've got P, V, Q, which means P or Q as disjuncts. So we might think kind of like P or Q. And meaning either one or the other or both. P or Q or both. Okay. Now just putting our truth values in here, P can either be, let's use the same ones we did before. The convention is to start with the truths and then the false. And in the first column, you can do this with more than one variable, and there's just a convenient way of doing this to try to get all the combinations. If you've got two total terms, you've got four here, and you put two truths and two falses, and then you alternate two false, two false. Okay, so that's the different possible combinations. Now, if P is true and Q is true, then my statement P or Q or both, is that going to be true or false? That'll be true. Okay. Because in this case, both are true, and so that makes the total statement true. If P or Q or both are true, then obviously if both P and Q are true, then the statement is true. Now, if P is true and Q is false, then my statement P or Q or both, is that true or false? It's true, right, because P happens to be true. And all I need to make this statement true is to have one or the other of them true, or both of them true. So, in this case, P is true and Q is false. Okay, now in this case, P is false and Q is true. Is this statement going to be true or false? It'll be true, right. P or Q or both. And in this instance, P is false and Q is false. So my statement will be true or false. It'll be false now because neither one of them is true. I had to have at least one of them true to make this disjunction true. If both are false, then P or Q or both is false.
Isn't your definition of the intrinsic or the
Oh, yes. Yeah, if you were going to, in other words, if you're going to take these little ors in here, yeah. I suppose you'd have to say that you're using exclusive ors to define the inclusive, because we're really making a composite of this. But I suppose you could say that.
Yeah, it
depends on how, in logic, you normally set it up this way, because I think the reason they do it this way is because it's easier to express the other in terms of this than vice versa. And because most of your statements in logic, most of the times that you're dealing with situations, is going to be one or the other or both that you're interested in, just to make the statement true somehow. If you've got the exclusive sense, well, there's a very, not very difficult way to express that in terms of the uses. This gives you, I hope, a good time.
Okay.
Now, but see, independent of this, this is actually what defines this function, this truth table. That's the real key. You know, it's not so much our language games, but this truth table is what defines this disjunction. This disjunction is defined as whenever you've got statements P and Q, if P is true and Q is true, then this disjunction is true. If P is true and Q is false, it's true. This one false. If either one of them happens to be true, then the disjunction is true. Both are true, it's true. The only way it's false is if neither are true. Okay, now, before we go any further, we need to discuss punctuation, because we're going to start putting some things together here. And you know as well as I do that in English, punctuation is necessary to make complicated statements clear. If you've got a complex statement, you need punctuation to really clarify it. For example, if I write the statement, the teacher says, John, cool. That statement can be quite a bit different if I punctuate it differently. If I say the teacher, comma, says John, comma, is a fool, then it's John's calling the teacher a fool. But if I take this out and says the teacher says John is a fool, just like that, then it's the teacher calling John a fool. The teacher is saying that John is a fool. So depending on how you punctuate that, you can completely reverse the meaning. And not only is that true in language, but it's even more true if you want to say it that way, or it's at least as important in mathematics. Let's suppose I put down this expression. Who can tell me the answer to that? Okay, before you tell me the answer, you're going to have to make a decision. Because if I've got to punctuate this somehow for you to know what I'm getting at. If I say this, 2 times 3 plus 5, then you get the answer 11. But if I say this, if I put my parentheses here,
2 times 3 plus 5, 3 plus 5 is 8, and 2 times that is 16. So you can see that your punctuation is very important here. It has to do with defining what these operators are operating on. And it's very important. Now you can see that this is going to be super important in logic also. When I'm dealing with logic and combining terms of logic, once I get beyond just simple conjunction, disjunction thing, I'm going to need to use some means of punctuating my logical statements. For example, let's consider this statement. Okay, P dot Q, V, R. Now, here we have the same kind of problem. This is a very ambiguous statement as it stands, because I don't really know whether this is, this could be the conjunction of the statement P with the statement Q, V, R, or it could be the disjunction of the statement R with the conjunction P dot Q. In other words, this could either be P dot Q, V, R like this, or it could be P dot Q, V, R. And those are really two different statements. They will not even have the same truth value. There are really two different statements. And so, in logic, we will use parentheses to set off the limits of a particular term in an operator. By this I know that this term, this conjunction term, operates on this whole function here, this whole unit, QVR. And in this case, I've defined my disjunction as operating on this whole term P dot Q. And you can see that this can make quite a bit of a difference in terms of just what term and what total truth function I'll have. Now, there's one maybe qualification here, and that is that by convention, well, first of all, we can use the parentheses, and in logic you'll also use brackets and braces, just like in math. Just different kinds of parentheses, just to sort of keep things straight so you know which terms are which. You can get some big expressions where you've got all the little ones with parentheses and then the bigger ones in brackets and so forth, and you keep working out. I suppose if you've got bigger than that, you maybe make bigger brackets or something and just keep going. But you try to do it in such a way that it's real clear what terms are being defined by what. Okay. By convention, though, the curl, the negation, by convention, is understood to apply to the smallest statement that punctuation permits it to apply to. It applies to the very smallest statement that the punctuation permits. So, for example, if I have the expression not P, V, Q, that this curl applies only to the P here, not to the whole expression. It just applies to the P. It only applies as far as the punctuation will permit. And this what this really means is not P conjunction Q. This whole expression disjunction with Q. That's what this really means. And for example, if I say not P V Q and P dot Q, this negation applies only to this term. It doesn't apply to the whole expression. That's not the same as saying not P. In other words, that's not the same. This is just confined to this particular term, not PVQ. And then that whole thing there, you might say, is being conjoined with this. So the negation only applies to the term that's immediately adjacent to it. If that term is enclosed in parentheses, it'll only apply to the term that's enclosed in parentheses and not beyond it. It won't go beyond that point. So that's, it's just to try to save some parentheses is what they're trying to do. Otherwise, you'd have to write it like this with parentheses around the whole thing, and then conjoin it to this, and that just gets cumbersome, a lot of parentheses. So we just knock these parentheses off and understand this negation is applying only to the term that's immediately adjacent to it. Now, it's possible that this term could be a whole great big expression, but when you see, I guess the key is when you see a negation sign and you see a parentheses in front, look for the corresponding parentheses on the other side, and that will show you the term that the negation applies to, not anything beyond it. Okay. You see, if this statement here is completely different, because here the negation applies to this whole thing, not just to the first term. All right. Now, let me just illustrate the fact that our punctuation of these two different terms does indeed affect their truth value. going back to this first one that we looked at, if I take one, P dot Q junction with R, put the parentheses that way, and then two, P dot Q, put the parentheses there, and you join them, and you have a disjunction with R. I'll show you that those two statements are different, and they have different truth values, just like arranging the parentheses on our little mathematical problem here resulted in different answers. Let's, for example, say that P is false, and Q is true, and R is true. Okay, if that's the case, then let's look at our first one, and we'll see if this statement is true. If we know that P is false, we can put a false under here, and we know that Q is true and R is true. So Q is true, R is true. Okay, it's just filling the value. Now, we'll work from the parentheses outward, and I'll make another statement about that in a moment. If Q is true and R is true, going back to our truth table, then the disjunction of Q and R is going to be what? True or false? That's to be true, yeah. Q or R or both will obviously be true if they're both the elements are true. So that disjunction is true. Then I'll just bring this down to the next level here. Now what I've got is a false statement. P, I've defined as being false here. And the disjunction between Q and R happens to be true. Now I'm conjoining a true statement with a false statement. And so that makes the conjunction between the two. If I've got two statements, one's false and one's true, their conjunction is going to be what? True or false? False. Right. So the total value here, this total expression, is false. That statement is false. If P is false and these two are both true, the statement's going to be false. Okay, but on the other hand, if I take it with the same expression with different parentheses and have P dot Q, now, with the same truth values, this is false, this is true, this is true. Okay, looking first at our parentheses expression, if P is false and Q is true, then the conjunction of those two is going to be what? False, right. Because for the conjunction to be true, both of them had to be true. P and Q both had to be true, okay? And then I'll just bring down the fact that this is true here just to keep the lines even. Now I've got a false statement here and a true statement over here, and I've got the or. So I've got a disjunction between a true and a false statement, and that's going to be what? True. So you can see that the truth value of this expression is false with these values, and the truth value of this expression is true with those values. And so those expressions are not the same. They're not equivalent. One comes up with false, one comes up true, depending on how you arrange each parentheses. So it is important that we put the parentheses in the right places. It's just as important as the symbol itself. Okay? That's all I meant to illustrate by this. Okay, now, from what I've done here, you can begin to see that any compound statement like this that's constructed from these simple statements using the dots and the V's and the curls has its truth value determined by the truth value the truth value of its component statements. Once I know whether these statements are true or false, I'm going to be able to determine the truth or falsity of the total compound unit by working in this way. Of breaking it down and working it out. And so if we know the truth values of the component statements, we can calculate the truth value of the total statement, the total expression. Now when you work a problem like this, the way you proceed is from the innermost components and work outwardly. So what you'll do is you find your parentheses, you see, and work out everything is in a parenthesis, like I did here. First I worked this out. I had both of these true, and so the disjunction is going to be true. And then I didn't do anything with this side, so I just bring down the value I had here, so keep them all in the same line and know what I'm working with. And now I work this one out, this dot, and I see I have a false on this side and true on this side, and by the rules of the truth table, I'm going to end up with a false in the total statement here. So you work from the inside innermost expression outward, and this is the way you'll come up with your truth tables. Now, let me give you another example of this. It's a little bit more complicated. And I'd like to give you a few take home with you to play with. Just about out of time here, but maybe we can rush through this. Let's take this expression. Okay, and let's suppose I know that A and B are
are true, and X and Y are false. Because I know that. Okay. So A and B are true, and X and Y are false. What I'm going to do is, first of all, since I know that X is false and A is true, I've got a true and a false here. Okay? And what Y was false and B is true, so I've got a true and a false here. Okay, let's start over here with B. If B is true, then I've got a not in front of it. Not B is going to be what? False. Okay? So under the curl, I'll put false. So, and I'll just bring down the false here. So now what I've got is a statement between two false things. Y is false, and not B is false. So their disjunction is going to be what? False. Because going back to your truth table, if both are false, then the disjunction is going to be false. So I've ended up with a false statement. This whole unit is a false statement now. Okay, working over here, I've got A is true and X is false. And I've got a conjunction between the two. Now, is the conjunction going to be true or false under these circumstances? False, right. Both of them had to be true in order to make the conjunction true. But notice I've got a parenthesis out here that negates this whole expression. So if this whole expression is false, the negation of it is going to be what? True. Okay. So what I end up here is a true statement on this whole side against a false one over here. And I've got a conjunction, a dot between them. So now I want to know whether I've got a conjunction between a true and a false statement, which is going to make this what? False. But now I've got a negation on top of that. See, I'm working out. So I've got a negation on this whole thing. And I just determined that this whole thing is false now. And the best way to put these symbols is right under the function operator. That way you'll keep it straight and then just work your columns down. This isn't, you know, if you find a way that's easier for you to write this down, go ahead and do that. But now the negation of this whole statement is going to be true because the whole statement is false. So this total expression then is true, given these values of X and Y. That's the result to come up with. Okay, I'd like to give you some exercises for next time. And I don't know if I can, maybe if you can just jot these down, just get a few of them. I'll just write them down on the board. You write it down on your paper and do just what I've done here. Tell me whether these expressions are true or false. In all of these cases, A, B, and C are true. X, Y, and Z are false. That you know. So plug those values into these expressions and tell me whether the whole statement is true or false. Okay, the first one is this. Number two. Three. Four. Okay, note 7, work it out under these conditions and tell me whether the whole statement is true or false. Number 7? Oh, yes, I slipped it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, leave them on, and we'll leave them on through the Greek class. If you don't have time to get them all down, you can come in . So that'll be due for next time. It really won't take you that long to do it. If you find yourself totally confused or something,
Feel free to get in touch with me about it or get in touch with one of the students if it feels like you know how to handle it, you know. Because what I want you to be able to go through the work and I want you just to do stuff with the cubes. All you're doing is exactly what I just did with this other thing. How do we do next time? And we'll go over the class and make sure you understand. So just go through it like I did. Putting your cubes and so forth. Work from the inside out. Work from your, you know, parentheses outward. And,
which number? Last section, number 7, the very last.
Okay. Right. Not Y, dot, not Z. Okay. I better get out of here.